Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Gates, how Erdic research affects you. Hope everyone is having a great Thursday so far. And we have a special guest with us this morning. I have Dr. Jarrell Smith. He is a research civil engineer with CHL. Good morning.
Good morning, Annette.
How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well.
I'm so glad. You're my second guest.
I feel special.
Well,
not
you
quite
are special.
Number one, number two.
Number two. Oh, well, you are special in so many ways, and we're going to learn just how special you are. The name of our show today is Are Beaches Really Running Out of Sand, and What Can We Do About It? So we're going to really talk a lot of information about sand and the importance of sand. So we're going to start by Dr. Smith. What is your role at Erdic?
I'm a civil engineer and a research oceanographer, and so what I do is study sediment. And so almost all of the missions of the Corps come back to sediment. How fast is it filling in our channels? How fast is it filling in our reservoirs? How is it obstructing navigation? And how do we remove it? And then what do we do with it once we remove it?
Well, that's a lot of stuff you get to do. And you travel a lot, don't you?
Travel a lot,
yes.
Yes. You know well.
Yes, I do. Okay, second question. What is the definition, and I'm going to say this probably wrong, is it hopper dredging? Is it hopper?
Hopper dredging.
Hopper dredging. I just want to make sure. And why should it be important to our listeners?
Yeah, there's several different ways that we remove sediment from the seabed, one of which plays into beach nourishment is hopper dredges. And so just think about hopper dredges as a vessel that has, you know, instead of containers on it or oil in it, we fill it up with sediment. And how that plays into how we nourish beaches is that they can move a lot of sediment. Like most of the hopper dredges that are used in the U.S. are about 3,000 cubic yards. Or if you think of that in terms of dump trucks, that would be about 300 dump trucks in one load.
Wow. Okay.
And the bigger ones are close to 5,000 or 6,000 cubic yards. So we're talking about 500 or 600 dump trucks in one load.
Right, right. And again, you know, we thought this would be a great show for people that are, you know, they're taking those beach vacations and they're gonna find out a lot of information that they didn't know before about how important what you do is for them. So number three. What's the average distance and cost to economically transport dredged material?
Well, there's a lot of variance in that. There are, you know, as the title of the show says, are we really running out of sand? And the answer is that we are running out of high quality sand. And so the distance that this is transported directly relates to the cost. Imagine if you had to drive from Vicksburg to Jackson to pick up groceries every time instead of just visiting a local grocery store. How much would you spend in fuel? And especially with the cost of fuel as it is now. So what we're doing is seeking to locate closer sources of sand that are acceptable to put on the beach. So whereas 10 and 20 years ago, we were probably dredging much closer to the beach, maybe 3 miles or 5 miles. Now we're having to go as far as 30 or 50 miles with each load in order to bring that sand to the beach.
Right, right. Okay.
So with that increased distance, of course, we're burning more fuel, taking more time.
Especially nowadays, it's a little bit more costly too on that
absolutely.
Fuel part. Well, okay. So what size sediment and type are best for beach nourishment, and explain the difference between erosion protection sediment versus beach enhancement?
Okay, so anybody who's been to a beach expects to find sand there, but you know the beaches around the world are composed of different things. If you go to England, you might find gravel on the beach, or to New England, gravel on the beach. But here in the Gulf states in the southeast is typically sand. And so sand ranges in size from about 0.6 millimeters up to about 2 millimeters. And what you find typically on the beaches in Mississippi is on the finer end of that range, probably around 0.1 millimeters.
Okay.
And so the size that we want to place on the beach, we try to match what is naturally there as best as possible, because those beaches have evolved to the shape that they have with exposure to waves and hurricanes and storms. They've developed their characteristic shape based on the size that's on the beach naturally. And so one of our objectives is to try to match as closely as possible the size that's already there.
And I'm sure the storms really, really mess with your job, doesn't it?
They do.
They mess with your job.
much more for the residents there, and that's right. Where the storm protection part comes in. The ability of storms to move sand off the beach, you might just kind of intuitively imagine, is related to the size. The coarser the sand, the more resistant to beach erosion. And so that does play a part. If we put sand that was too fine there, it would quickly be moved offshore by the next storm. And so that plays into, again, how much protection the beach offers to the communities that lie inland. And that plays into the storm protection part of your question.
Right.
We recognize also that beaches provide recreational benefit, not just storm protection. And so cities and counties may elect to also place additional sand on their beach because a wider beach is more attractive to tourists and those who use the beach in a recreational capacity.
Well, does it have anything to do, I know this is not on our questions, but does it have anything to do with the color, the different colors of the sand?
Yeah, color is one of the metrics that is used by the state of Florida, and they've developed this legislation, this kind of colloquially referred to as the sand rule, and it has a set of requirements for sand to be placed on beaches. Mm-hmm. One of those requirements is color. The other we've talked about is size, mm-hmm. and also the amount of fine sediment that's in that, and also its mineral content. Like a lot of the sand sources that are out offshore have a lot of shell in them. And shell is just not durable like sand is. It would quickly abrade and go away, and it has a less aesthetic characteristic as well.
Okay.
So color does play a part, not only for attractiveness for us to look at it. We know that a lot of the Gulf Coast beaches are just beautiful white sand.
The white sand. That's all you hear, you know. Look at the white, beautiful sand.
But other places around the country, it's darker. Like where I grew up, in the Carolinas, the sand was more gray colored. And that was just a component of the minerals that were in the sediment or that are in the sand in addition to quartz. If you have pure quartz, it'll be a very white beach. If you have other heavier minerals, it lends a darker color to it. So Florida sand rule says that we should match the color of the natural beach, much in the same way we do its size. And so that does become one of the requirements for many beaches, because a lot of states emulate Florida's rule in their own practices.
That's very interesting. Okay, who normally funds transportation costs to nourish a beach?
Well, the taxpayers do.
Okay. Next question.
So that would be you and I,
right,
and everyone else.
Okay.
But it's divided up differently depending on the nature of the project. Like often there's a federal, state, or federal, local cost share, and the federal government pays 65% of it, and the locals pay 35%. And that local contribution can come from state or local municipalities, who often see this as a great benefit to them, that, you know, they can pay one third of the cost and reap economic benefit from, you know, tourism and other uses of the beach.
Right, right. Okay. Next question. How long does it take to analyze the sediment you need for beach enhancement?
Yeah, this all starts with sending someone offshore to collect some samples. And, you know, this plays into the overall cost of the entire project. For instance, we'll send usually a ship offshore that will collect cores in the areas that we're targeting. But usually before that, even also a ship goes out and uses echo sounding, much like is done in the oil industry, to search for in their case, mineral resources, which would be oil. We are looking for sand resources, and you can tell by the reflections of those acoustics off of the seabed what kind of material is there. And then once you locate favorable locations, then you send a crew out to take samples. They would take those samples, usually long cores, 10 or 20 feet long. They're brought up on deck. A geologist will characterize them on deck, and then they pull samples to send back to the lab. We have a lab in Vicksburg, but there are many located all across the U.S. that these samples are sent to. Then they sieve them to determine what size granular material is in them, how much fine content is there. And at that point, you'd have an accurate map of what's there on the bottom. You know, we certainly can't see it from above the water surface. And, you know, like we talked about, these sites may be close to the beach, but a lot of those have already been used, or they may be as far as 50 miles away.
Wow. Okay. So, next question. What different types of dredges are used for this purpose, and explain the differences?
So the main two types of dredges that are used for these kind of projects are hopper dredges, which we talked about. Those are the ships that vacuum the sediment up off the bottom into their hold. Then they bring it to shore. They usually hook up offshore. In a study I was working on, this hookup point was 5 miles offshore. So you could hardly even see the beach where this hookup is. And then they re-slurry what's inside the hopper and pump it through a pipeline all the way to the beach. So they're pumping it 5 miles offshore.
Wow.
To the beach. And then usually there's a crew on the beach that handles moving the pipe around and smoothing the sediment out once it's placed on the beach. Now that would be hopper dredging.
Okay.
The other type is pipeline. So it's a direct hydraulic. There's usually a what we call a cutter head on it. And you might imagine that that looks just like an egg beater. And it rotates around the intake on the pipe. And it's the job of the cutter head is to disturb the sediment and allow the pump action to pick that sediment up and pull it into the pipeline. And in that case, it's much like the hopper dredge hooking up to a pipeline, except we have one pipeline that goes from the cutter head all the way to the beach. And that would be for sources that are either at inlets or in protected water, because this cutter head dredge can't take the waves like a hopper dredge, a ship can.
Okay.
So those are the two types.
Okay.
The study that I was involved in, the objective of it was to look at how much of the fine sediment contained was being lost from the operation. So we were stationed on the hopper taking samples and evaluating how the fines content, the silt and clay, was being removed throughout the process.
Okay. All right. Next question. What type of research goes into finding the specific type of material that you need? Ooh, that's a big one, isn't it?
It is. How much time do we have?
We still have quite a bit of time.
So this is the really interesting part for me, because a lot of what we talked about, this research done over the past 50 years has kind of established how we do this. But the work that I'm doing is determining how we do that better. How do we more readily use the resources that are close to us? Because that, like we discussed earlier, the Florida sand rule requires that we don't put more than 5% fine sediment on the beach. And so 95% of it has to be sand. And we only have a tolerance for up to 5% of what we call silt and clay. That's the stuff that would make the water cloudy. If we just took a jar of sand and water and shook it up, that's what would make the water cloudy. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do is to determine, recognizing that when we dig with a hopper dredge, there's water and sediment released, and that's usually the fine part. And then when we place on the beach, there's more of that fine sediment washes out. We know that some of it's lost. And so the historical practice to now has been that if there's 5% out there on the seabed, we don't pump it to the beach, even knowing that we're going to lose some of it.
Right.
And so the research that I'm doing is determining how much of that fine sediment's lost between when we pick it up off the seabed and when it finally rests on the beach as a finished project. And so I did this work down. You might remember that Ship Island was cut in two by Hurricane Camille.
Yes.
And then when that gap was beginning to close, and then when Hurricane Katrina came along, it widened it again. And so it was about a mile wide gap. And it gave us a great natural laboratory to determine how much of this fine sediment is removed. So the dredge I was working on, it was dredging out offshore of Pascagoula and actually hauling that sediment all the way to just offshore of Biloxi. So imagine every time you're picking up sediment, you're hauling it from Pascagoula to Biloxi. That was some, I think, 35 miles.
Right.
And then pumping it out. And so the one load would take about 3 hours.
And wow. So, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. So with the cooperation of the dredging industry, we got on their dredge. We took samples from the hopper. We had these samples, like we talked about, that were taken from the seabed. So we knew how much fine sediment was there. We measured how much fine sediment was trapped in the hopper. And then we measured it again on the beach. And that way we determined how much fine sediment was lost from that sediment while we were working. And it turned out it's about 90%.
Wow.
So that makes a huge difference. So now instead of targeting sand offshore that has 5% or less fines, we can now target quite comfortably 10% and maybe even as much as 15%.
Was that a wow moment?
I think we kind of intuitively expected that there was a lot of it lost, but we did not know that it was 90%. And so, yeah, that is a wow moment. For that project, the offshore sediment was 4.4%. So if we're applying the Florida sand rule, that's very borderline sediment. And what we placed on the beach was 0.5% fines. And so much cleaner. And by comparison, the natural beach there has about 1% fines. And so what we were placing on the beach was actually a little bit cleaner, if you will, in terms of sand content.
Wow.
Okay. So the impacts of this are that if we start looking at projects around the U.S. coastline, is that we can use the existing dredging sites longer. Like there, for instance, at a beach off the coast of Jacksonville, we've estimated that increasing the fines content, as our study suggests, would expand the lifetime of that supply for 50 years. So 50 years beyond its current capacity.
That's good, right?
The reason that's good is because that site is just 10 miles from the beach,
right.
and the other candidate sites are 50. So
right. We
can continue shopping for groceries in Vicksburg as opposed to going to Jackson.
Gotcha.
And for a long time, the sampling and the exploration for these other sites is also very expensive. That effort can cost many millions of dollars. And so we've postponed the search for those additional sources and the testing of those additional sources for 50 years, which represents millions and millions of dollars of savings. So we as taxpayers should be very happy,
I'm happy.
About the outcome of this. So, it's saving taxpayer money, doing the job faster and better and cheaper, which is what we want to do as the Corps of Engineers.
And that's part of the research. That's the research.
That's why we do it. And research doesn't always pay off like this. Mm-hmm. There are many times that we chase dead ends, but it's the reason that we do it is to find these opportunities for savings and doing things better. And that's why we do the research. And of course, it's very fulfilling when it does pay off.
Right, right. Okay, next question. What are some optimal sand resources that could be utilized that may or may not have been used yet?
Well, one that immediately comes to mind is all of the sand that we dredge out of navigation channels. And so historically, we have operated with the mindset of, let's get this material out of the channel. For a long time, it was called dredge spoils. And that, okay, that kind of connotates that it's a waste product.
Right.
But in reality, it's very valuable, as we've seen. If we have sand available to us close to a beach, then it represents a valuable resource. And so, fortunately, the mindset has changed over the course of my career to treat sediment as a resource. And one of these sources that would be available as a source for beach nourishment or other applications is what we just dredge as a part of keeping navigation channels open so shipping containers and oil tankers can access our ports.
Okay.
You know, we're doing that work already. We have the material in the hold. Why can't we just have a small incremental cost and place that on the beach or somewhere where it's beneficial? So those sources are already available. There's some that we have to visit annually. And so this research and other research is allowing us to investigate those as sources of material to place on the beach. The research that I just described is also applicable to these sources. They often have 10 or 20% fine sediment in them because these channels are deeper areas. They trap more of that finer sediment. But we realize that a lot of that's removed as part of the process. And so it makes that material become available to applications closer to shore.
Okay.
Now, we do place sediment directly on the beach, like I described earlier, but mm-hmm. sometimes we place it just offshore of the beach. And then we let the waves and the currents work on it further, and they will clean that sediment even more and make it, by the time it arrives to the beach, make it clean beach sediment. You mentioned other sources of sediment, and the core, I mentioned that we're talking about changing practices and advancing and using more of this material. The core actually has a informal policy objective to beneficially use 70% or more of our sediment in the near future. And so this includes not only sand, but, you know, we talked about how undesirable these fines are on the beach. Well, they're also desirable in other locations. Mm-hmm. So when we dredge muddy sediments, we're also trying to make benefit of them, to make them apply to an area that needs them. And one area that needs mineral sediment right now, these clays and silts, are the coastal wetlands that you might see behind the barrier island beaches. That's where you see the salt marsh grasses. Mm-hmm. These are very rich ecosystems. There's a lot of shorebirds that use those as nesting habitat. There's ospreys use that as nesting habitat. There are fish and crab species that spawn in these areas. And because of sea level rise, a lot of these areas are being drowned or not able to be used as nesting habitat or spawning habitat because they're becoming too deep. And so much like we would use the sand from a navigation channel to put on a beach, we're also using this muddy material that is not very aesthetically pleasing to us, but is essential for those habitats back in the salt marsh. And so those are other uses that we're applying to achieve this 70% beneficial use of dredge material in the near future. And that's good not only for the birds, for the crabs, for the shrimp, for all of the creatures that use that area, but it's good for us too, because mm-hmm. we now don't have to haul all of that mud outside of the system and place it in a disposal facility. We can use it locally within the system, provide nourishment to those areas at lower cost to the taxpayer.
Okay. And I know the taxpayer likes that.
I do.
A lot of people think, well, wow, you got a cool job. You're always on the beach. Yes, I'm testing sand. So, okay. Explain the regulations and obstacles city and state government agencies may have in starting the process to enhance local beaches.
There's more than you would imagine.
Really?
To check. So we've talked about the beach color, the sand size, mm-hmm. the shell content. But there's also factors like, you know, we're not the only critters that use the shore.
Right, critters.
there are sea turtles. I'm not a biologist, but, mm-hmm. You know, they're also important users of the beach. That's where they dig their nest and lay their eggs. So it's a very important place for turtles. And in many instances, places where turtles couldn't nest because there wasn't enough sand, this practice of us placing sand on the beach for storm protection or for recreational benefit has provided a benefit also to the turtles in that they now have a place to lay these eggs.
And so they're particular, is that what you're saying?
They are. They need they need a pile of sand to lay eggs in.
Right.
And so often our work kind of provides that habitat for them. One thing that's interesting about turtles, and this is one reason that color plays an important part in our job, sand color, that is, mm-hmm. Is that you probably know this, walking across a light-colored concrete pavement in bare feet mm-hmm. is a lot more comfortable than walking across asphalt in bare feet.
A little bit, especially but, today, maybe.
Because the color of the sand determines how much heat from the sun it soaks up. And this is important to the turtles because the sex ratio of the hatchlings is dependent on the temperature of the sand. And so if we place darker sand, that is thought to heat up and generate a different sex ratio than if it's, you have a lighter colored sand. And so it's generally more beneficial to the turtle population for that to be a lighter colored sand. It produces more females.
Well, that's a wow moment for me.
Whereas the warmer sand generates a higher proportion of males.
Wow. That is,
and
that's wild.
Hopefully I've got that right. Because
okay.
The biologists will, I'm sure they'll probably throw eggs at me when I get back on station if I got that wrong.
Well, I won't let them, okay? That is amazing. So any other creatures that, besides the turtles, you think that the regulations and obstacles are centered around because of those particular things? Or
well, there's also wading birds. We see them foraging in the surf mm-hmm. when we go to the beach. There are horseshoe crabs use this habitat. And so that comes into some consideration when we're planning our operations, because by placing sand on the beach, we're kind of disturbing that habitat mm-hmm. in a way. And so we aim to do our work, one, during a time of year when turtle nesting is not happening, mm-hmm. so that we're not disturbing that activity.
Which is about when?
Turtles nest now, during the summer.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And so often a lot of our work, our enjoyable time on the beach, is done when it's cold outside and winter and rainy. But we do avoid turtle nesting season when we're placing the sand. The other obstacles municipalities have are, you know, vetting out that sand source to make sure it's compatible. And they work with the Corps of Engineers in that activity. Mm-hmm. We both review the data. They also have to come up with their portion of the funding, and these projects have to be funded by Congress mm-hmm. For us to work on them. So they're always making their case on the level of protection for their communities, and their congressmen, are advocates for them in that respect in Congress.
Okay. Okay. Now, this is real, real important. How many positions / people are involved in the hopper dredging projects?
Who? There are probably hundreds.
See, that'll be mind-blowing in itself.
But, you know, every step along the way, from sending someone out with a ship to echo sound the bottom, you know, that requires a team of people and a specialized vessel. And then once those areas have been sought out, we have to send another team in a specialized vessel to go out and collect samples. You know, that's another team. And then once those samples are back in the lab, there's a team processing those samples. There's a team of scientists and engineers evaluating the compatibility of that sediment with the beach. And we haven't even started doing anything yet, right? And
preparing.
We haven't moved a bucket of sand yet. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of work done in preparation. And then once the project funds are in, that dredging team, there's probably 20 people on the dredge at any time. Mm-hmm. And they work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Wow.
There's usually two shifts, and they operate in six hours on, 6 hours off. I will say, working on that hopper, the cook is the most important person.
Oh, yes.
Because they do feed their crew and, fortunately, their guest very well.
That's always good.
So, you know, there's a lot of jobs, from the person who's maintaining the equipment on the barge to the staff that are preparing the meals for the crew, the captains and pilots working up in the house, and again, working 24 hours, 7 days a week. And those projects will often take something like 4 or 5 months for them.
That's what was my next question. Like, you know, them working that long, how many months or...
Yeah, the sizes of the jobs, we measure the quantities that go on the beach in million, or usually cubic yards. Mm-hmm. And so, like for instance, a dump truck holds about 10 cubic yards.
Okay.
And so many of the beach projects are several hundred thousand cubic yards. And so we're talking hundreds of hopper loads. And they might be upward to 1 million or... 1.5 million cubic yards. So with those kind of quantities, there are a lot of trips. And again, this plays into how long is the transit time between the beach and the borrow source. So if we're only having to go 10 miles, mm-hmm. we can get this done much more quickly than if we have to go 50 miles.
Okay. I know a lot of people are going to be going, when they lay out on the beach now, they're going to be looking at it a whole different way.
When you lay on the beach, it's hard to imagine that there could be a scarcity of sand, because, right. I mean, that's all that's there.
And right.
you think that if you ever get sand in your pocket or in your shoe, it may take years for you to get rid of all that sand. But the reality is it is a finite resource, and it's becoming scarcer.
So they need to save the sand they have in their shoe.
Don't take it home.
Don't take it home.
Back.
Just dump it back in the sand, in the beach. Just dump it back. Don't take it with you home. Okay, so the last question is, what do you want people to remember from this valuable conversation?
Well, I think one thing that I'd like for you to take back away is just look at the beach when you're there. Imagine how much sand is there. There's hardly any recreational beach that doesn't get some supplement from the work that the Corps does. And so, you know, think of all the different factors that went into constructing that beach, that there are people working to improve the way that we go about this work. We still have a lot of work to do, by the way. We've done one study. We're looking for a demonstration project. We think that'll be in the state of Florida, mm-hmm. where we can demonstrate on a wider scale that this research that we've talked about pays off and makes good sense, both environmentally and economically. But enjoy the beach, but but look at the sand and appreciate all of the effort that that goes into.
But y'all travel all over. I mean, you guys are.
We do.
Where there's beaches.
Where there's beaches, and mm-hmm. A lot of my work deals with mud, which we don't want on the beach, but you know, is part of the Back Bay and the Mississippi River Delta system. We travel all over to Alaska, to Hawaii, from Galveston to Bar Harbor, Maine.
I bet the Hawaii sand is unique with the volcanoes and stuff like that.
There are. They have green sand beaches there.
Wow.
Which are, it's a specific mineral. Mm-hmm. We talked about the darker beaches of the Carolina coast, and you'll see that some around the Mississippi as well. Those are from dark-colored minerals like hornblende and feldspar. Those olive green beaches in Hawaii are mm-hmm. from a mineral called olivine, and they're spectacularly beautiful. But one thing about olivine is that it's a lot softer than quartz, so it just doesn't last as long. That's why we don't see green beaches everywhere.
And you won't see a green castle because you can't build it if it doesn't. It's too soft, right? that's the way I'm looking at it.
Yeah.
Can't have a sandcastle. Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of our show. And I want to thank you for being with me today. This has been fun.
Oh, I had a great time.
Hopefully you'll come back and talk to us more about some other things that you're working on. And again, this is Dr. Jarrell Smith. He is with the Coastal Hydraulics Lab. And we will come back at you next week and talk to Dr. Chris Griggs with the Environmental Laboratory. So again, have a great day. And thank you for listening to Beyond the Gates. Talk to you next week.